From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I'm also grateful to several Iraqi citizens who helped save my life while I was in their hospital. And then a unit of our Special Forces soldiers did save my life.
Jessica Lynch comes home. What actually happened to her in Iraq? Also, the U.S. military says it has killed both sons of Saddam Hussein. We'll speak with Patrick Coburn in Baghdad. A judge drops terror charges against radical attorney Lynn Stewart.
Yesterday afternoon, Judge John Codal in the Southern District gave me personally and the movement a great victory, a long-looked-for victory, and reinstated the Sixth Amendment when he dropped the major terror charges against me.
We'll speak with Lynn Stewart and her attorney. And will librarians continue to be in the crosshairs of the USA Patriot Act? We'll talk to Congressmember Bernie Sanders. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The top U.S. military commander in Iraq says his troops yesterday killed Saddam Hussein's two sons, Uday and Qusay. They were the most wanted men in Iraq besides their father. The deaths occurred in Mosul after an intense gun battle Tuesday. 37-year-old Qusay was once seen as Saddam heir apparent. He headed the Special Republican Guard and the nation's other elite security services. 39-year-old Uday headed up the Fedayeen militia. We'll have more on this story in a few minutes. Meanwhile, in Mosul, a U.S. soldier was killed, six others wounded in a bomb attack today. Another U.S. soldier was killed when a military convoy was attacked in Ramadi, 60 miles west of Baghdad. Two more soldiers were wounded. A total of 235 U.S. soldiers have now died since the U.S. invaded Iraq. The White House admitted yesterday the CIA had sent two memos in October voicing strong doubts about the claim that Iraq attempted to purchase uranium from Africa. The White House received the memos 3 months before President Bush made the false claim in the State of the Union address. Until yesterday, the White House had insisted it was not until after Bush's January speech that it received the CIA warnings that the uranium claim was false. But Bush's Deputy National Security Advisor, Stephen Hadley, yesterday took the blame. Hadley admitted he'd personally spoken with the Director of Central Intelligence, George Tenet, in October before the president's October 7th speech. Tenet, at that time, had asked that the Africa allegation be removed. It was removed from the October speech. Yesterday, Hadley said, "I should have recalled that there was controversy associated with the uranium issue." Hadley claimed his boss, National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice, didn't know of the CIA's concerns. Meanwhile, more than 400,000 Americans have sent letters to Congress calling for an independent investigation into whether Bush lied in the lead-up to the invasion of Iraq. The letter-writing campaign is organized by the group MoveOn.org. California Congressmember Henry Waxman has introduced a bill that calls for the creation of a nonpartisan commission to probe the White House's misuse of intelligence. 63 lawmakers have sponsored the bill so far. A federal judge yesterday threw out the two main terror charges against civil rights attorney Lynn Stewart, charged by Attorney General John Ashcroft for abetting a terrorist organization by representing her client. Lynn Stewart joins us in just a few minutes. U.S. troops and Iraqi police have raided and closed down the offices of a new newspaper in Baghdad. The editor of the paper, Al-Mustaqila, was also arrested. U.S. forces felt the paper was inciting violence. The Washington Post reports the U.S. has banned all Iraqi media from publishing or airing material that could be viewed as inciting political, religious, or ethnic violence or promoting attacks on U.S. forces in Baghdad. Already shut down have been a Baghdad radio station and a Shiite Muslim newspaper in Najaf. The international press group Reporters Without Borders have criticized the press rules. The Bush administration yesterday threatened to veto any bill that would seek to overturn recent changes by the Federal Communications Commission to the nation's media ownership rules. There has been growing bipartisan support in Congress to roll back the FCC's new rules, expected to result in the greatest media consolidation in U.S. history. We'll talk about this issue in a few minutes on the show. Following protests from British Prime Minister Tony Blair, the Bush administration yesterday announced it would not seek the death penalty for two people from Britain being held on Guantanamo Bay, who they are scheduled to be tried by a secret U.S. military tribunal. There has been an outcry in Britain over the Brits not being returned to Britain. In Liberia, President Charles Taylor has offered to leave the country within 10 days as fighting eased in the capital city of Monrovia. There were also reports that opposition groups had ordered a ceasefire following some of the country's most intense fighting. More than 600 Liberians have died in recent days. The New York Times reports Taylor announced he would leave during a phone call arranged by an American evangelist, the Reverend K.A. Paul, whom Taylor described as, quote, my religious leader. And the Iranian-Canadian journalist Zahra Kazemi has been buried in Iran. She died on July 10th after being beaten by Iranian police. She suffered a fractured skull that caused a brain hemorrhage. Her Iranian and Canadian family had called on the Iranian government to return her body to Canada, but Iran has ignored the requests. Dalida, Hawaya Baladi, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The top U.S. military commander in Iraq says his troops have killed Saddam Hussein's two sons, Uday and Qusay. They were the most wanted men in Iraq besides their father. The deaths apparently occurred in Mosul after an intense gun battle Tuesday. 37-year-old Qusay was once seen as Saddam's heir apparent. He headed the Special Republican Guard and the nation's other elite security services. 39-year-old Uday headed up the Fedayeen militia. The military also says they killed Qusay's 14-year-old son, as well as a bodyguard. Four U.S. soldiers were injured in the attack. The New York Times reports the U.S. military leaders believe the killings may lead to an immediate wave of retribution attacks. In the long run, officials hope the deaths will demoralize surviving Ba'ath Party members and other opponents of the U.S. occupation. Some in Baghdad say Uday and Qusay were more feared than even their father. Celebrations in Baghdad last night went awry when a unit of the Florida National Guard mistook the celebratory gunfire as an attack. USA Today reports the U.S. troops shot a man twice in the chest, and a young girl, who may have only been six, was shot in the head. We turn right now to Baghdad, where Patrick Coburn is standing by, a reporter for the London Independent, actually joining us from London, recently back from Iraq. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Patrick.
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us. Your comments on what the U.S. military is now saying, that they have killed both sons of Saddam Hussein.
Well, I think it is true. I don't think that... It's like previous claims that Saddam had been killed by airstrikes, which turned out to be untrue. It's very unlikely that there was a mistake that made in identifying the bodies. But it's also, one should bear in mind that the guerrilla warfare may not be against the U.S. and British troops, may not be affected by this at all, because there's no real evidence that Uday and Hazai or Saddam himself have been coordinating the attacks.
The news apparently is not being believed by many in Iraq, and so there have been suggestions that the U.S. will release pictures of them today.
Yes, I mean, it seems likely that that will happen. I mean, because of these previous exaggerated or false claims, clearly when something like this does happen, Iraqis and others really want to be sure about it. And maybe one that one should be a little bit reserved, but I'm pretty convinced in my own mind that Uday and Hazai.
Can you talk killed. About the two sons and what they represented in Iraq?
Sure. They drew all their power from their father. They operated independently in that they ran the security services, they oversaw the Republican, Special Republican Guard, the Fedayeen Saddam. But there was never much sign that they had any political independence. Uday, in particular, was an extraordinarily nasty piece of work. He frightened people. He seems to have taken a certain joy in inflicting pain. There was always something a little mad about him. And Iraqis in general would be extremely glad that he's dead. I'd always thought he was the most unpopular man in the regime. I mean, even more than his father.
There are also reports the Arabic television is playing another tape of Saddam Hussein.
Yes, one can't tell if all these tapes are authentic, but I'm sure some of them are. And there's no doubt just the fact that Saddam is alive and the fact that these tapes are getting out sort of underlines the a certain lack of control by the U.S. in Baghdad and in the countryside round about it.
We're talking to Patrick Coburn of the Independent newspaper, just returned from Iraq. The latest news, the U.S. military saying both sons of Saddam Hussein have been killed in a gunfight in Mosul. This issue that the report of people celebrating in Baghdad and U.S. troops, Florida National Guard, opening fire on them.
Yes, I mean, this has happened before several times. Iraqis are naturally armed. And when they celebrate, they shoot into the air. When they mourn at funerals, they shoot into the air. There have been continual incidents like this, continual friction. It's kind of ironic that this should have happened this way, but and each time it does happen, then more Iraqis are turned against the present occupation.
You talk about the guerrilla war not being over now, not believing that it was the sons who were directing the opposition to the occupation. Can you elaborate on that, Patrick, based on your reporting in Iraq?
Well, Paul Bremer, the chief U.S. Official there, says that the attacks are not centrally coordinated. And also talking to Iraqis after attacks, people who've been standing by, when I've asked them what they thought of the attacks, they've generally been all in favor of them. It doesn't mean necessarily people want Saddam back. I don't think they do. But there's no doubt that these attacks are pretty popular. And one sees that again and again. And maybe that's the most significant thing. It's not exactly who's carrying out these attacks, but they seem to fit in with the popular mood at the moment in the whole of central Iraq.
Overall, Patrick, what was most striking about your trip to Iraq in comparison to what you hear when you're outside?
I think it's what's most striking is what struck me most, and I think strikes Iraqis most, is the failure to get Iraq up and running again. I mean, this should not have been too difficult. The collapse of the looting, the collapse of the government after the fall of Baghdad, and the fact that even now, several months later, that people are living in worse conditions than they were under Saddam Hussein. As I said, it doesn't mean that they want him back, but their expectations are much greater, and their anger against the occupation is increasing.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Patrick Coburn joining us from London now. He's with The Independent, recently returned from Iraq. And you are listening to Democracy Now! As we turn now to our second story, Private Jessica Lynch has come home.
Hi, thank you for being here. It's great to be home. I would like to say thank you to everyone who hoped and prayed for my safe return. For a long time, I had no idea so many people knew I'd been missing. But I read thousands of letters, many of them from children, who offer messages of hope and faith. I would like to thank the people in this community, especially those who gave donations to the Lynch Fund and who volunteered their time and skills to work on my family's house. Please allow me to thank the doctors, nurses, and staff members of Walter Reed Army Medical Center for the excellent care they gave me. I'd like to thank the staff of Landstuhl Medical Center in Germany for their care and support. I'd like to thank the Fisher Foundation, Governor Bob Wise, and United States Senator Jay Rockefeller for the roles they played in helping my family to be with me in Germany and Washington. I'm also grateful to several Iraqi citizens who helped save my life while I was in their hospital. And then a unit of our Special Forces soldiers did save my life. I want to thank Sergeant Reuben Contreras. Reuben, you never let me give up. When I wanted to quit PT, you kept me going. And you're my inspiration, and I love you. I'm proud to be a soldier in the Army. I'm proud to have served with the 507th. I'm happy that some of the soldiers I served with made a home alive, and it hurts that some of my company didn't. Most of all, I miss Lori Payestua. She was my best friend. She fought beside me, and it was an honor to have served with her. Lori will always remain in my heart. I've read thousands of stories that said when I was captured, I said, I'm an American soldier too. Those stories were right. Those were my words. I am an American soldier too. So thank you for this welcome, and it's great to be home.
And that was Private Jessica Lynch returning to her rural West Virginia community yesterday amid bristling flags, yellow ribbons, TV news trucks. She suffers from multiple broken bones and other injuries, is able to walk with the aid of a walker, but still has trouble standing. On Monday, she was awarded the Bronze Star, the Purple Heart, and the Prisoner of War medals. Jessica Lynch first gained national headlines when she was captured in the first week of the Iraq invasion. On March 23rd, her Army maintenance unit was ambushed near the Iraqi city of Nasiriyah. 11 U.S. soldiers were killed and 5 others captured in the attack. Lynch was taken to the hospital by Iraqi soldiers and held separately for 9 days from other patients as she was being taken care of by Iraqi doctors. The press initially reported that Jessica Lynch fought fiercely during the attack, getting stabbed and shot several times as she fended off her assailants. News articles described her emptying her M16 into Iraqi soldiers, killing several of them before finally getting caught. The initial initial reports of her subsequent rescue 9 days later were also dramatic. They described Army Rangers and Navy SEALs storming the Nasiriya Hospital just after midnight. The press reported they came under fire but managed to find Lynch and whisk her away by helicopter. The military provided video of the rescue with its night vision camera and released it to the public. Since then, enterprising reporters have shown the reality of both Jessica's capture and rescue were very different. New reports conclude that Jessica Lynch was injured when her Humvee crashed into another vehicle in the convoy. Reports also found the convoy blundered into the ambush after getting lost. Many of the unit's weapons malfunctioned during the battle. Of her rescue, Iraqi doctors at the hospital said later that the U.S. had faced no resistance when they came in. Lynch herself was not quoted by the television at the time, did not comment on what had taken place as she was recovering, although her father did say, after the Pentagon said she had suffered from amnesia and could not comment on the attack, her father said that she did not suffer from amnesia. The Washington Post was the first to report the heroic version of Lynch's capture. The paper came under sharp criticism from its own ombudsman, Michael Gettler, for its handling of the story. He will join us by telephone, the first U.S. journalist to question the reported version of events on April 20th. The Post later published a 5,000-word expose on Lynch's capture, completely debunking their original version of the story. We're going to go to break. When we come back, we're going to play the first piece that Democracy Now! Ran before the BBC and Washington Post expose. It was with London Times reporter Richard Lloyd Parry, who found a very different story when he investigated the so-called rescue of Jessica Lynch from the hospital. That's after this break. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. Coming up, Lynn Stewart will join us in just a few minutes. A judge has dropped terror charges against her. We'll also talk to Congressmember Bernie Sanders about the USA Patriot Act, a bill that has been introduced that would take librarians out of the crosshairs of the bill. But right now, we're going to turn to that first report Democracy Now! Did with London Times's Richard Lloyd Parry after he visited the hospital in Nasiriya where Jessica Lynch was being treated.
When I was in Nasiriya, this was a week or so ago, I stayed in the general hospital, principally because it was at that point the safest place in town. Protected by both by Iraqis as well as by a small number of American Marines. And while I was staying there, I got talking to one of the hospital doctors and asked about Jessica Lynch, because this, of course, was the hospital from which she had been plucked by U.S. Special Forces in those very dramatic pictures that were shown while the war was still going on. And this doctor and others of his colleagues told a very interesting story. They too had heard the official American version, which was put out in Qatar, and they'd had described to them these exciting infrared pictures of special forces going in, walking through the corridors of the hospital, and carrying this injured woman out. But to them, it was all rather amusing. They were rather sardonic about it, because they said that, among other things, there was no resistance at the hospital. The Iraqi soldiers and commanders who had been there had fled several hours before, really the day before. So these special forces didn't have to fight their way in at all. They walked in. And they also said that although they, as civilian doctors, had been struggling really rather hard for a week or so to save Jessica Lynch's life and to give her the best treatment they could, that they were treated really very badly by these soldiers who came in. A number of the doctors, as well as two patients, including one paralyzed patient, were handcuffed, shackled to beds, had their hands tied. One of the senior hospital administrators was actually taken away in the U.S. Special Forces helicopter with Jessica Lynch and held for 3 days in a prisoner of war pen in the sun. And they felt that this was really very, very poor treatment for the honest job they had tried to do in saving her life. And they felt that they, at the very least, they were getting very little credit for the job they'd done.
How did the story that we came to know in the United States, how was it constructed?
Well, I saw, I think, like most people, on one of the live briefings from Doha. I can't remember which particular general it was doing the briefing. But it had clearly... It came at a stage in the war when they were a bit short of good news to put out. And I remember at the time that clearly a lot of thought and preparation had gone into this presentation. You know, the story was told from the point of view of the rescuing forces. There was very little mention made of any of the Iraqis in the hospital or those on the Iraqi side. And it was portrayed as a very dangerous mission carried out to save this, you know, this young, rather attractive young woman. And it was clearly a PR coup at the time. But it wasn't like that. As far as I can remember, no one at the time really questioned the Pentagon account that had been put out. And because there was fighting still going on, it was very difficult at that point to get the other side. But, you know, it struck me as interesting and significant that these doctors had their own story to tell.
Richard Lloyd Perry of the London Times, he reported that in the paper on April 16th. We had him on April 28th. Just before that, Michael Gettler raised a question about his own newspaper's reporting in the Washington Post, and he joins us on the line right now. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Michael Gettler.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's good to have you with us. You're the ombudsman of the Washington Post. Can you talk about the evolution of this story and how your newspaper and so much of the rest of the press and the world got this story wrong?
Well, I will. I'd be glad to. But I should make one point on your previous segment. The Washington Post, his initial story is at the heart of when she was first captured, the heart of this dispute. But on April 15th, I think prior to the report you just aired, it was also Washington Post correspondent Keith Richburg who got to the hospital in Iraq where Private Lynch was being held and reported, based on doctors' on-the-record comments, that she hadn't been shot, she hadn't been stabbed, that she was injured in the Humvee accident, and that she had been well cared for. So the Post actually had that story first as well. But the problem was it was back on page A15 or 17, I don't remember exactly where. It was way back in the paper, and it was based on Iraqi sources. And, of course, it didn't get the attention that it otherwise might have gotten. But the Post actually did, their foreign correspondents actually did begin to pick away at this story before, I believe, anybody else did. The original story in the Post appeared on April 3rd, and it was very dramatic. It had a headline that she was fighting to the death, and it talked about, as you said earlier, that she was part of the ambush. She fired, continued firing at the Iraqis even after she had sustained multiple gunshot wounds and watched several other soldiers die. that she was she actually killed several Iraqis and that she was stabbed as they closed in to her position, which was obviously a very, very dramatic story at a time when there was really no good news coming out of the war front. The original story did have cautions in it, but it was further down. It made clear that this information was coming from sort of battlefield intelligence and monitored communications, and from Iraqi sources in Nasiriyah, whose they said whose reliability has yet to be assessed. And so, and the Pentagon never actually confirmed it. They just didn't deny it, but they didn't confirm it. So my initial reaction to the story was that it should have been written more cautiously because there were these caveats further down in it, and that the story should not have been presented in what really did look like a propagandistic kind of account. But in any event, the reporters clearly were these are experienced reporters, and I never had any doubt that they were told what they were told. Just the question initially of whether or not they should have been more cautious and careful in how it was presented. But the very soon after that first report appeared, there was the there was a report from Germany from the Landstuhl Hospital where Lynch had been taken. By the commander of the army hospital there, this Colonel David Rubenstein, and he said that the evidence, the medical evidence, did not suggest that any of her wounds were caused by either gunshots or stabbing. That also, which I thought was very important, was seriously underplayed by the paper. It was included in inside another story way in the back of the paper. But it was also on television, and readers of the Post got very angry after that, where they felt that that original story had been very misleading and had been propagandized, and it looked like an agenda was being pursued there. And that's when the controversy really took off.
We're talking to Michael Gettler, ombudsman at the Washington Post. Also very important to point out when this story came out, at a time of the so-called quagmire, when the Bush administration was getting a lot of heat for getting what looked like bogged down in Iraq.
Right.
And this was the myth that came out of that time. Also now, the CBS News is apologizing for offering Private Jessica Lynch quite a deal if they could do the CBS movie on her. They would. They wanted to do a CBS News exclusive, and they offered her a made-for-TV movie, an NTV special that might include a special concert in her hometown. Now they are saying they may have overstepped, and when they raise the possibility of the movie deal and other entertainment-related incentives. Your response to that?
Well, you know, my focus has always been on the journalism, and in all the columns that I've written about this, I've tried to make clear that this has nothing to do with Private Lynch, who is a courageous young soldier and who has been through a terrible ordeal no matter what happened. My concerns have been with the journalism surrounding the story, and that's where I think there were some flaws. And the Post did move to do a very, very lengthy investigative piece 2.5 months later that sought to correct the record before the Army investigation came out. I was also somewhat critical of that because it actually put the real correction, saying that she wasn't shot, she wasn't stabbed, actually was on the jump page on the continuation inside. And it still didn't quote anybody on that point, even though there had been a Defense Department official quoted in the New York Times saying exactly the same thing about 4 days earlier. And it also, the fault I found, it suggested that the Post was not alone. And in its phrasing, it talked about initial news reports, including those in the Washington Post. And actually, the Post was the exclusive had the exclusive on that that first story about the details of her capture. So I don't want to comment on other news organizations and what they did or may have done or were planning to do. I do think that, in general, the press was quite slow to try and go back on this story, which kind of seemed fishy almost from the start, as soon as Colonel Rubenstein made his comments.
Well, Michael Gettler, I want to thank you for being with us, Ombudsman of the Washington Post. As we turn now to the federal judge who dismissed two main terror charges against prominent civil rights attorney and her two co-defendants, U.S. District Judge John Kuttel said the charges against Lynn Stewart conspired to support a terrorism organization were unconstitutionally vague and, quote, reveal a lack of prosecutorial standards. Stewart was facing a possible 40-year jail sentence. Prosecutors had accused her of passing messages between her client, the imprisoned Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman, and his followers in Egypt. Rahman was convicted of conspiring to blow up several New York landmarks and to assassinate the Egyptian president, Hosni Mubarak. He's serving a life sentence. The judge's ruling has left intact charges that Lynn Stewart and her two co-defendants conspired to defraud the U.S. and that Lynn Stewart made false statements. But the dismissal of the first two counts of the five-count indictment is a major blow to prosecutors. The case had been personally announced in April 2002 by Attorney General John Ashcroft. He held a news conference and then further discussed the issue that night on the David Letterman Show. U.S. Attorney James Comey was unwilling to concede defeat, saying in a statement, he still believes the law prohibiting material support for terrorism is constitutional and that an appeal is possible. Well, we're joined in our studio by Lynn Stewart herself, as well as her attorney on the telephone, Michael Tiger. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Happy to be here, Amy.
So how did you get the news yesterday and your response?
We got a phone call from Michael saying that the judge had called him to have us pick up this decision. For an hour, we sat around the office and chewed on our fingernails, not knowing whether it was 77 pages of good news or bad news. But I got a call from Ahmed Sattar's wife, who had gotten a call from his lawyers to say that the first two counts were dismissed. And it is a major victory in a time when we don't see too many victories for our side.
Attorney Michael Tiger, talk about the judge's ruling and on what grounds he made it.
The ruling holds that the First Amendment to the United States Constitution, freedom of speech, press, association, and petition, requires that if you're going to limit speech, you have to do so with statutes that let people know what they can and cannot say or do, and that this statute, as applied by these prosecutors, flunks that test. I think the significant thing is that the defense of Lynn Stewart has always been a defense of the right to defend, the right to counsel. And, of course, if you empower brave lawyers like Lynn Stewart, you help people. But this opinion goes broader than that. It says that this prosecution is an attack on the right of all people to express themselves. And that means that the judge has taken a view of the First Amendment that empowers not just lawyers to defend people, but all people who want to talk about, to protest and analyze current American policy in the Middle East.
Lynn Stewart, this case does go forward, though, and it goes forward on the lesser charges. Can you talk about those charges?
Yes, and one of the reasons why I want to take a shout-out to all my many, many people who have supported me with their whole hearts and souls in this, all over the country, Milwaukee to Fort Lauderdale to the Bay Area, is that it isn't over till it's over. And they still have serious charges. And, of course, any conviction would take my license away, remove me from being the defender. And so we still have a big fight on our hands, and we're going forward with that fight. I spoke to Michael late last night, and we agreed that we're not going to lessen our attack because we are sure they're not going to lessen their attack.
That's
so
right.
even with these terror charges out of the picture, we all know that they can get you on a technicality, and we're going to fight that as hard as we can. We think the facts are with us on these charges.
What does this mean for other attorneys, Michael Tiger?
It means that lawyers who give their services to represent people accused of terrorist crimes, so-called terrorist crimes, can breathe a little easier if this opinion holds up. This case was, from the beginning, an attempt to chill the exercise of vigorous advocacy. So let's hope that some more lawyers take courage and others join the fray.
Actually, in the judge's opinion, Amy, he goes so far as to say that the government failed to explain completely how a lawyer acting as an agent of her client, an alleged leader of a foreign terrorist organization, could avoid being subject of a criminal prosecution under the government's theory in my case.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Lynn Stewart, human rights attorney, arrested April 2002 on charges that she helped her client, Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman, deliver messages from his Minnesota prison cell to his followers in Egypt. The judge has dropped the two main terror charges against Lynn Stewart and her two co-defendants. When we come back from our break, we'll be joined by Congressman Bernie Sanders on various aspects of the USA Patriot Act. One key provision there was a bill last night that was very significant in rolling it back. We'll also be talking about how the Republicans are going after a DNC ad that highlights President Bush's statement in a State of the Union address making the false allegation that Saddam Hussein was trying to buy uranium from Iraq. Stay with us. You are listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to the USA Patriot Act. In another major setback for the Justice Department, the U.S. House of Representatives last night voted 309 to 118 to overturn key provisions of the act. It marks the first time the House or Senate has voted to roll back portions of the controversial act, which was approved with little debate 1 month after the September 11th attacks. Last night's vote attached a provision to a $38 billion appropriations bill that would block the Justice Department from using any funds to secretly search homes. Over the last 2 years, the Justice Department had overseen 47 of these so-called sneak and peek searches. The House is also expected to vote this week to roll back another provision of the USA Patriot Act that allows the FBI to secretly obtain detailed information on patrons from libraries and bookstores. Vermont Congressmember Bernie Sanders is one of the chief sponsors of that legislation. He now joins us on the phone. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Congressman Sanders.
Thank you.
Let's start off with what happened last night. The significance of that rollback.
It was a big deal, and it was a very big surprise. The fact that almost all Democrats voted for that provision, and over half the Republicans did, showed the Justice Department, for the very first time since the USA Patriot Act was passed, that there is massive discontent with the anti-civil liberties provisions in that bill. So I think it was a great victory. Unfortunately, yesterday, because the deal was made between the Republicans and the Democrats on the floor of the House, a number of us were not able to offer amendments. The amendment that I would have offered would have stopped the FBI from going into libraries and bookstores with virtually no probable cause to determine the reading habits of Americans. We're going to fight hard to get that provision put into place. If we can't do it in the House, we'll do it in the Senate. But yesterday's vote, and by the way, I should tell you that the person who introduced that amendment was a conservative Republican. So I am feeling much more optimistic today than I did yesterday that the USA Patriot Act is going to be, it's going to get a very, very hard look, and hopefully we'll be able to take out some of the onerous provisions in it.
Now talk about the aspect of the legislation that you are taking on,
right,
the one that puts librarians in the crosshairs of the USA Patriot Act.
That's quite right. Essentially, and I think many Americans don't know this, that under the USA Patriot Act, the FBI can walk into a secret tribunal, secret judge, and basically say to the judge, we are doing an investigation on international terrorism. That's all they have to say, and of course they are. Having said that to the judge is obliged to give them permission to walk into a library, walk into a bookstore, and find out the books that you have taken out or the books that you have purchased. On top of that, the librarian or the bookstore owner may not tell you that you are under investigation. And this is clearly an outrage for a dozen different reasons, but many librarians all over this country are worrying about the chilling impact it has on people's reading habits. Is somebody going to take out a biography of Osama bin Laden? Are you going to read a book on anarchy? Are you going to read books which might be quote-unquote controversial if you think the FBI is going to know what you are reading and that that information will get out? So what I'm very happy to say is we have the support of the American Librarians Association, who have been very, very active on this issue. The booksellers all over America have come out and say, hey, the people of this country have the right to read what they want to read. If the FBI has reason to believe that somebody is a terrorist involved in terrorist activities, there are proper law enforcement mechanisms by which we can investigate those people. So the good news is that I think yesterday's victory, as you indicated, this is the first time that an aspect of the USA Patriot Act has come to the floor of the House, and it was soundly defeated. I think the extent of the victory surprised a lot of people.
What does this mean for Bush, since all of this has taken place in the context
clearly,
of the presidential campaign?
Remember, as I've indicated a moment ago, this particular amendment was brought up by a fellow named Butch Otter of Idaho. And what it should tell the Bush administration and Mr. Ashcroft is that people all over this country, including a conservative United States Congress, say you have gone much too far. Yes, we want to protect the American people from terrorism. That, in fact, is very important. But we can do that without undermining the basic constitutional rights of this country. So I feel better today than I did yesterday. We're going to work as hard as we can, either through the Senate or one way or another through the conference committee, to get the freedom to read legislation incorporated in there as well.
Congressmember Sanders, I also want to talk about the FCC and the new media ownership regulations. The New York Times reports today there's growing bipartisan support in Congress to roll back Michael Powell's new rules that are expected to result in the greatest media consolidation in U.S. history. Yesterday, the Bush administration threatened to veto any bill that would seek to overturn the recent changes by the FCC to the nation's media ownership laws. Then a magazine reported that Michael Powell was thinking about stepping down, though he has denied this. What is happening in Congress around this?
Well, yesterday, let me back it up and tell the listeners that right now, clearly one of the major concerns that many of us have who are worried about democracy in America, the diversity of opinion that a democratic society requires, the main concern is that what we're seeing every year is fewer and fewer large multinational media conglomerates owning what we see, hear, and read. It is a hugely significant problem. As a result of the decision by the FCC on June 2nd, a green light was given out to these companies to override, to go beyond many rules that have been set in place for years, to actually increase in a significant way media concentration in America. Fewer companies would own more and more of the media. What I did is introduce legislation which would rescind what they did on June 2nd, bring us back to where we were. Maurice Hinchey of New York State is working on legislation which would take us a lot further in determining how we can create a more diverse and democratic media. But that was the 1-2 strategy. In the midst of all of that, within the Appropriations Committee, legislation was passed in the House Appropriations Committee, which would deal with one part of the problem, and that is giving a major television network the ability to go from 35% to 45% in terms of the viewing audience, what that television station could own in terms of local affiliates. That was passed in committee. It was also passed yesterday on the floor of the House because it was contained in the overall bill. More importantly, though, and what some of us see as a more serious problem, is the issue of cross-ownership, and that is the capability of a large company to own, and this is what Michael Powell has allowed to happen, to own within a small city, if you like, the local television station, the local radio station, the local newspaper. That does not sound like freedom and democracy to many of us. Maurice Hinchey brought that bill on the floor of the House. Unfortunately, in in my view, a very stupid tactic, the Democrats who were managing that bill opposed, although presumably agreeing with Hinchey on this cross-ownership stuff, opposed them. We ended up with 174 votes. We should have done a lot better than that. And, in fact, it seems to me we are quite close, in the House at least, to having the votes to completely override what Powell did.
Finally, Congressmember Sanders, you have signed a letter asking Vice President Cheney 10 questions. You sit on the Subcommittee on National Security, Emerging Threats, and International Relations. You're joined in that letter signing by Dennis Kucinich, who's the ranking minority member, and Congressmember Carolyn Maloney of New York. Can you tell us what these questions are?
Well, just very briefly, I think a lot of Americans are deeply concerned about the Bush administration's statements that got us into the war and the whole question of whether or not Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, whether or not they were obtaining uranium from Africa and so forth and so on. And in the midst of that, while most of the attention has been focused on the president or the Secretary of State or the Secretary of Defense, the truth of the matter is Vice President Cheney, as many people know, was also active in this process. There is some strong evidence to suggest that he has been putting a lot of undue pressure on the CIA and the other intelligence agencies. And from what we can gather, and this is what the questions were about, basically not just simply trying to find out what they knew, but putting pressure on them to move them in a direction that they themselves did not feel comfortable about. So the bottom line is of the questioning is, what role did Cheney play in trying to influence the intelligence agencies to provide inaccurate information to the president and to the American people?
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Congressmember Bernie Sanders of Vermont, an independent congressman. By the way, the 10 questions for Cheney, the letter that Congressman Sanders and others have signed, can be found at tompaine.com. As we turn now to our last segment, attorneys for the Republican Party are warning TV stations not to air a new commercial by the Democratic National Committee that charges President Bush misled the country in the lead-up to the invasion of Iraq. We're going to hear a bit of that ad right now, which begins with the sound of typing and the statement written across the ad. In his State of the Union address, George W. Bush told us of an imminent threat.
Saddam Hussein recently sought significant quantities of uranium from Africa.
The ad goes on to say, America took him at his word, but now we find out that it wasn't true. A year earlier, that claim was already proven to be false. The CIA knew it, New York Times, July 7th. The State Department knew it, New York Times, July 6th. The White House knew it, NBC News, July 26th. But he told us anyway, the ad says. And then it goes on to repeat the quote.
Saddam Hussein recently sought significant quantities of uranium from Africa.
And then the ad types out, it's time to tell the truth. Help hold George W. Bush accountable by calling for an independent bipartisan investigation. And it says go to www.democrats.org/truth to sign the petition and make your voice heard because America deserves the truth. So that's the ad. The video, Republicans are saying the ad is, quote, deliberately false and misleading, not because it states what George Bush said, but that it says that he pointed out that the disputed information came from the British government and that the ad doesn't point that out. We're joined on the letter on the phone right now by Terry McAuliffe, chair of the Democratic National Committee. Welcome to Democracy Now.
Amy, good morning.
It's good to have you with us. So what is your response? The Republicans say that they will sue any TV station that runs this ad. They sent a letter to a TV station in Wisconsin.
Well, the stations don't think much of it, Amy. They all decided to run the ad, except for, shocking as this may be, Fox News. They're the only stations that decided not to run it. So I guess they do decide what they want to put on their TV. The issue is George Bush's words. It's not like we used an actor and put words. These are George Bush's actual words to the State of the Union. They like to say, well, you didn't mention the British intelligence. Here's the whole issue. The British intelligence had supplied intelligence to our intelligence. Our intelligence, the United States of America, said that these words were incorrect. State Department knew it. CIA knew it. Our president should rely on our intelligence. And when he knows that our intelligence is saying it's not true, another foreign intelligence is saying it is true, you always rely on our own intelligence. We know what they wanted to do, Amy. They wanted to puff this up. They wanted to try and make the strongest case. They wanted to scare Americans to make them believe that Saddam Hussein was, you know, processing nuclear rods to scare the American public. We know exactly what they were trying to do. It is misleading. It was not the truth. They deliberately did it, and they should be held accountable. And all we're asking for is an independent, bipartisan commission.
The letter says the Democratic National Committee certainly has a legitimate First Amendment right to participate in political debate, but it has no right to willfully spread false information in a deliberate attempt to mislead the American people. As an FCC licensee, you have the responsibility to exercise independent editorial judgment, not only oversee and protect the American marketplace of ideas essential for the health of our democracy, but also to avoid deliberate misrepresentations of the facts. The letter concludes, such obligations must be taken seriously, this letter puts you on notice that the information contained in the above-cited advertisement is false and misleading. Therefore, you're obligated to refrain from airing this advertisement. I was wondering whether the false and misleading part was what Bush said, that there was a connection between Saddam Hussein and Niger, or what the ad went on to say.
I think they chose a poor choice of words by using the word misled in their letter, because that's what we're alleging, that George Bush has misled the American public. And as I say, the advertisements are up and running. We're going to continue to do these ads. We had, Amy, 80,000 people come to the Democratic website, Democrats.org, sign a petition. Thousands more every day are signing this petition. They want an independent bipartisan commission. We know what George Bush did. He did not tell the truth. There was deliberate attempt to shade the truth in what he said in the State of the Union. Listen, the State of the Union is the Super Bowl of political speeches. More people watch this than any other political event. They watch the State of the Union. George Bush went up there and misled the American people. He misled the world to justify his use of troops over in Iraq. We have troops there now. We support him 100%. But we now have a serious nuclear crisis in North Korea and Iran. Now, when the president speaks about those two countries, can we believe him now? And people around the world, as you know, most countries have now turned against us, which is very unfortunate. We've built great relationships, you know, over 100 years of our country. Now they're going to look at us and say, is he telling the truth, or is he just manipulating the words to justify doing some further action?
Well, Terry McAuliffe, I want to thank you for being with us, chair of the DNC. Of course, we called the Republican National Committee. They said there was no one available to justify their attack on the Wisconsin station that is running the ad. That does it for the program. If you'd like to get a video or audio copy, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Our website's democracynow.org. You can go there to join our daily digest list. Democracy Now! Produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, Lenina Nadal, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.